The HD View.
Okay, that's going to put a smile on your face. Happy Tuesday, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the HD View. This is Dr. Mary Edmondson is with us tonight. We're so excited. And this is Melissa Biliardi, your host. Our call-in numbers are 310-982-4227 and 877-497-4103. If you have questions or comments when you call in, just press 1. We'll cue you into the show. Please tell all your colleagues, friends, and family about HealthRHD Radio and click follow on our show page to get email reminders of upcoming episodes. Thank you, 76,200 listeners, for tuning in. Something real quick I wanted to mention. For those of you who are listening through the app or the my website, HealthRHD International website, or through the events page, we would love to have your comments, your questions. And in order to do that, you will need to log in to the blogtalkradio.com/HelpForHD site to get into the chat room on Blog Talk. And you might try that next time, but for this time, we'd love to have you, and we appreciate you calling in if you can on those numbers. Tonight, our incredible special guest is our very favorite, Dr. Mary Edmondson. She's MD psychiatry from Duke University, HD Clinic, and HD Reach. HD Reach, she's going to tell us all about that tonight, but it is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing access to care, education, and social assistance to patients and families. Dr. Edmondson, I want to welcome you back to the show tonight, and how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
That's great. Well, you know, the last time you were on, We had 54,000 listeners, so we've kind of increased our listenership since you were on. Tell us, tell us why did you create HD Reach? Tell us about that.
You want the long story or the short story? I guess I'll give you the short story. I have worked in and around Huntington's families for 30-plus years. And when I originally started working with Huntington's families, there was a tremendous amount of misinformation and, you know, really pretty horrible stories and just a lot of inaccurate information even within medical texts and so forth. And so at that time, I had the good fortune of meeting Marjorie Guthrie and Nancy Wexler. And they sort of opened my eyes to what Huntington's really is and not just the press. And, you know, at that time in the early 80s, I listened to everything they had to say, and I thought, well, they've got, you know, great ideas, and this is going to help. And then I went to medical school, and I went and did my residency and so forth and got caught up with my career. And as the years went by, I figured things were better. And when I finished my psychiatry residency, you know, I knew that there were two neurologists in North Carolina that worked with Huntington's families and did HD research, and very good people. And so I started a support group in the Raleigh-Durham area. And one of the first people that I originally met about 10 or 15 years ago was a really lovely woman who had just been diagnosed with Huntington's and was one of the kindest, sweetest women. And for the 10 years after, in between when I first met her and after I finished my psychiatry residency, she wrote every thank you note for our chapter. I mean, she came to every fundraising event. She was just a steady force and was very, very well liked and appreciated. When I finished my psychiatry residency, her family came to me, you know, kind of in a desperate situation. They had her in a nursing facility, and they were kind of uncomfortable with how things were going for her, and they talked the nursing home doctor into letting me come and see her. And she was having lots of difficulty with perseveration or, you know, obsessive compulsive symptoms. And I was new in practice, and I didn't, you know, really, I didn't have a lot of confidence. You don't have a lot of confidence when you immediately come out of your residency. And so I tried everything that I could think of for this lady, and I really could not make her get better. And I thought, well, certainly it must be me. You know, it's because I don't really have enough experience or I don't have the right connections to ask people what they would try in this situation. And, you know, so I said, but I'm not going to give up. I'm going to do one last thing. I'm going to send a bunch of labs off on her. And that afternoon, I got a phone call from the nursing home physician who was taking care of her. And he completely chewed me out for ordering lab work on a woman who was, you know, had a terminal illness, and what would we treat anyway?
Oh, gosh.
You know, her blood work came back, and she had some markers in her blood that things weren't going right, and she had this back pain we couldn't figure out, so she got x-rayed, and sure enough, she had metastatic cancer in her spine. And, you know, I just thought to myself, she was just trying to communicate that pain in the only way that she knew how to do it. And we weren't listening.
Mm-hmm.
And so the truth of the matter is, well, of course you would have treated her back pain differently. And of
mm-hmm.
course you would have treated it differently. And it dawned on me, you know, here it is, what was that, 2004, and I thought, you know, the message is not getting where it needs to go. The message is not getting to those people who are the first folks to see Huntington's patients, or the last people, the last doctors who see Huntington's patients. And they're not, the message isn't getting through a lot of the way in the middle either, although, you know, families get pretty resourceful. They find radio shows like yours, and they find HDSA and other forms of information and,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, educate themselves and figure out who are the HD experts in the area, and they end up there, which is great until people start getting sicker and they can't leave their home communities. And they have to rely on their family practitioner again. And so it just dawned on me that there was this big gap in care, and there was a big gap in access to care,
mm-hmm.
and that there was a big gap, at least in my state, between what somebody needed to make a difference in their life. Maybe it was physical therapy, or maybe it was some assistance with getting a medication they couldn't afford, or whatever. There was a gap between the need, in other words, a doctor writes you a prescription, and actually executing that plan. You know, there's 10 things that can get in the way between a doctor writing a prescription and a patient taking a medication reliably.
Mm-hmm.
And it just dawned on me that we needed something. We needed something that bridged the gap between families and their doctors. And so in North Carolina, we have 3 different tertiary care centers that work with Huntington's families. 2 of them have HD clinics, and the third runs a genetic testing program. And not any one site had a center of excellence type of a program, but between all of us, there was a lot of expertise. So we got together with the North Carolina chapter, and we decided that we needed to do something that would bridge that gap. And the Center of Excellence model didn't entirely fit our state, so we figured that we had to do something a little bit different. So we did. We formed HD Reach. It was originally called the North Carolina Center for the Care of Huntington's Disease, but that's just too much of a mouthful, so we changed our name.
Yeah.
So we recruited a social worker who started with us in 2010. We spent 3 months training her before we, you know, let her go. And since that time, she's developed a clinical program that has reached 300 patients and 250 healthcare providers, and is just a wonderful, wonderful person, and is an absolute pit bull. She will not give up till she finds what somebody needs. And we kind of figured out the areas in our state where people were having the most difficulty. So, like, disability was one of them, getting disability approved.
Mm-hmm.
So we started working with our HD doctors at Wake Forest and at Duke, coming up with ways that they could write the letters that would be accurate,
mm-hmm.
but would be more convincing. And
mm-hmm.
since we did that, we have, you know, much better success getting people disability. So it's all about executing what we know is good care. you know, knowing what's good care and executing it are in two entirely different things. And so that's what we're all about.
Mm-hmm.
That's the long story, I guess.
That's a good, no, but, you know, how many other states are in that same situation where, you know, for example, we're too far away from centers of excellence. So I'm, you know, working with our local doctors. But to have a model such as what you're describing is something that can be duplicated.
Well, we would like to think that. So one of the things we figured out is that our state is 500 miles from mountains to the coast, and it's 75% rural and 25% urban. So there's a large number of people that are going to have difficulty getting to tertiary care centers, mm-hmm. and are going to be cared for in the community. So we thought if people only had to drive an hour, that might be better mm-hmm. than if they had to drive four. So what we're trying to do is create little satellites around the state where we have a case manager, and we identify some doctors and some ancillary providers. And that's what we were working on. We had created a satellite program in Charlotte, which is the second largest city in North Carolina. And we knew there was a relatively large group of people down there. And we had a couple folks who were real interested in helping us do it. So we started a support group down there, and we were getting ready to figure out how we could mobilize the medical community in one way or another. How could we engage them in taking care of patients? And that was when the HSG announced they were going to have their annual meeting in Charlotte in November, which was, I mean, timing couldn't have remotely been better.
Now, with all of this organization that you're working on, are you finding more families that are affected?
Well, yeah. It's, you know, it's kind of hard to know. The estimates are 3 to 7 per 100,000. Those are 1970 statistics. And more recently, there's been some information that's come out of England and British Columbia that the incidence of Huntington's is more like 10 per 100,000 or 1 in 10,000, which would mean that there's 1,000 patients in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And our center, our two HD centers follow between 250 and 300 patients. We have contact with 300 patients. A lot of them are the same people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the folks that are way out there that we haven't had as much success getting to them. But it's also a phase of illness where people go looking for help, right? They go looking for help when someone's diagnosed,
right.
And they go looking for help when somebody is getting more difficult to manage at home. And they go looking for help when they realize they're at risk for Huntington's and they're trying to figure out what they want to do with their life. So those are sort of the three touch points where people come to see us. And so I think, you know, having contact with 300 people in 3 years is not bad.
No.
I mean, you know, because the rest of those people are out there living their life and they're working and they're taking care of their families and hopefully having fun. So, you know, they don't need us in their life at that point in time. So we should, you know.
Right.
We're happy not to be in their life at that time. So.
Yeah. Well, and there's got to be some family planning going on somewhere along the line, too, hopefully.
Yeah. So we just sort of get up every day and we do what comes to us and hope we can, you know, do the best we can to help people find things that will make their life better.
Now, I did notice on your website, your HD Reach website, that you have some really fantastic resources for folks. Are you able to follow the patient through to for example, maybe placement, that kind of thing, nursing homes, board and cares, that kind of thing?
Well, a lot of times people, I'm thinking about a particular case, a particular person we're working with right now, that we've recommended that they pursue that. And we have partners in the community that will work with people. We've identified a number of different case managers who take on someone's case like that and help a family get through it. And we typically hear when how things are going. People, you know, they let us know whether it's they're having a lot of trouble. And so we don't always do the exact work. We find people that will do the work, which spreads us farther, right? So the more people that we know who can help our families, and the more they get, they learn about Huntington's, the more our partners learn about Huntington's, you know, the better it gets. But for the most part, we recommend it. We recommend case managers. We make sure that people connect. And we usually follow up once or twice to make sure that things are going okay, and then we sort of leave it in the hands of the family to get back with us if they need us. So,
seems kind of how to be that a lot of placement and then replacement and then replacement. It's
mm-hmm.
kind of something that I've never heard about that before, because I've never had to deal with it in my own situation, but I know others who have, and it really is a difficult thing for families to manage, even though they're not
mm-hmm.
actually caring for the HD person, but they're having to follow the person at each facility, trying to reconvince and re-explain everything to new facilities about what's happened, and I don't know. There's got to be a system that can help with
well,
that.
Well, I think that for an average person with Huntington's, I don't know what that means, but, you know, somebody that has midlife onset Huntington's and they proceed through the stages of Huntington's that we kind of recognize, and they proceed through these touch points that I talked about earlier. It seems to me that people with Huntington's need two different kinds of facilities in their life. When they first begin to need additional assistance and there's no direct caregiver in their home that can take on that role, and so they have to go live someplace besides where they're living, they don't need to go into a skilled nursing facility. They need to go into an assisted living facility. And in that assisted living facility, they, you know, maybe someone gives them their medications, or maybe somebody prompts them to go down and eat meals with everyone. But in general, it's just a more protected community, and there's somebody sort of keeping an eye out on what's going on with that individual. And
mm-hmm.
and that works for a while. It works for actually, you know, potentially, you know, 2, 3, 4 years. And then when people have more difficulty with activities of daily living, which is, you know, eating and clothing yourself and eliminating and that type of stuff, that's when people need skilled nursing.
Mm-hmm.
And when that time comes, it's difficult for everybody to figure out. And all of it is complicated by the fact that people with Huntington's have behaviors. And they have behaviors that they have behaviors that are misidentified as, people are misidentified as having Alzheimer's, as opposed, without realizing that the dementia of Huntington's is entirely different than the dementia of Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the only thing a lot of people know about, right? So that's the closest they've got, and so they draw upon their skills that they developed working with Alzheimer's patients, and they apply them to Huntington's patients, and sometimes they just don't work.
Mm-hmm.
But the people that have the most difficulty, I think, in this world are people that have a combination of medical and psychiatric problems, and they need assistance outside their home. We are not alone in that. Schizophrenics who develop end-stage renal disease, or bipolar people who have an appendectomy. So we really are not alone. And there are some facilities that are staffed to do better with certain kinds of patients than others. And so the key is figuring out which are the facilities that have the people that have the skills to take care of people with Huntington's like behaviors. Mm-hmm. And then once you figure that out, then, you know, somebody can go give them an in-service and little light bulbs will go off in their head and they'll go, oh, so that's why he does that. A lot of it has to do with, I think, having the support of physicians who can help you. And I don't think they necessarily have to be Huntington's doctors. I think that they can be doctors that are in the community, and they know some things about who are the nursing facilities, for example, that might do better with people that have some behavior issues. They're likely to know about local resources much better than me, living halfway across the world, you know. So the more that you know about what's going on in a local community, the better those needs could be met. But that physician also needs to rely a little bit on people who have more expertise with Huntington's so they can advise that doctor that, you know, to try this or try that. For example, when I finished my residency and I saw this really lovely woman and the thought went through my head, I don't know what I'm doing, you know, certainly there's somebody smarter than me that could take care of this problem. If I had at that point known, you know, some of the Huntington's psychiatrists that I know now, that would have been an easy phone call. I just didn't know who they were, right? So if we can just make that stuff easier for people to get to, and you know, in fact, doctors anywhere can email a question to something called PsychLink that HDSA does, and a psychiatrist will give some type of an answer to a local provider, like, this is what's going on, what would you suggest I think about? And and so you get someone to sort of walk you through some general steps that you might consider. Then they'll send you information, they'll point you to references and so forth. So
right. Not for a crisis situation, though. It's
no.
A 72-hour turnaround. So, I mean, informational, great, you know. But what would you suggest for crisis? Say there's a behavior issue and you're in crisis.
So I would say the best thing you can do is see that they're coming and get your ducks in a row before they come. That's really easy for me to see because I've seen lots of Huntington's, the course at Huntington's multiple times. It's a lot more difficult for somebody who it's the first time they've ever seen Huntington's to realize that the reason that they're having problems is because the disease is getting worse. And because their disease is getting worse, they're needing to use these Huntington's behaviors to communicate in ways they are unable to anymore. That's kind of the way I look at it. So, but obviously, if you're in a crisis, then that strategy doesn't work, right?
Right.
So one of a couple things happens. You call the police, and the police come to the house, and they realize that things are okay, that nobody's got knives and guns and so forth, and so they don't have any imminent reason to drag that person into an emergency department because they're not upset now. So that's one scenario that might happen. And typically that happens a couple of different times before the police get it, that this problem is not going away. And somewhere in the middle of that, if families understand a little bit about involuntary commitment in their state, I can't tell you exactly how things are in your state, but I know in North Carolina that anybody can petition for a psychiatric evaluation involuntarily. You can go to the magistrate, you can present your case to the magistrate, and the magistrate will make a decision. They'll make a decision about whether or not the facts that you have given to him merit that type of an involuntary commitment assessment.
Mm-hmm.
So please go pick somebody up, take them into an emergency department, and there sits they have to be seen by a psychiatrist or a mental health professional. And that's when it's really, really helpful to go in armed with some information for that individual.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, you want to be able to tell them that these are the things that you've tried and that have not worked, and here is what you've been doing, and whatever your plan was has failed, and that this person that you love, their life is in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm.
And point out to them that they're going to look a whole lot better than they can function, and this is why.
Mm-hmm.
And so you go in armed with you get prepared, and you go in armed with information for that doctor that says, that makes a pretty compelling case for why your loved one is in harm's way.
Mm-hmm.
Or whether the people around that person are in harm's way. And you're not going to get involuntarily committed unless that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody is involuntarily committed and they go to a psychiatric facility, those hospitalizations, in my experience, are very difficult on people with Huntington's. They are put into a general psychiatric population of people that may be more aggressive than they are, and or more sick than they are, really.
Mm-hmm.
And it's frightening.
Yeah.
So
now,
I don't often see those.
Is that a situation where you can do in-service with the staff?
Physicians? So that physician can be given information to contact.
Mm-hmm.
They can email PsychLink. Two, they can call a center of excellence somewhere and ask to speak to somebody who would be willing to staff their case with them.
Mm-hmm.
My hope is that I think that we're hoping to be able to evolve to that place where we can actually help people staff their patients and sort of supervise them over the phone.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a perfect world, in a couple years we'll get telepsychiatry and we'll be able to actually interview the patient with that individual.
Mm-hmm.
That will open up all kinds of doors for everybody. That's really what needs to happen. And it needs to happen with somebody that is a credible HD doctor. Like,
mm-hmm.
you can't just walk in and say, well, here's the information and you need to read it, because they're not going to pay attention. They're not going to pay attention
mm-hmm.
to somebody
true.
That they perceive doesn't know as much as them, and they
mm-hmm.
and they need to speak doctor language, you know. And, I mean, I'm sorry about that, but we do kind of have our own language. And we do. It's just
listen to caregivers much. Unfortunately,
not everybody, right? Not everybody.
Yeah.
But there, so the hope is that as things move forward, that there are going to be better ways to reach into communities and
mm-hmm.
better ways to reach to people who have to rely on care in the community.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason.
Hopefully we'll have a better network for that.
This year at the HSG, there's going to be a presentation on novel forms of healthcare delivery, and I think one of the posters is actually about telemedicine in Huntington. So it's beginning.
Yep.
So
I actually have a survey that I need to get to Ray. Still, I fully intended to get it to him sooner, but things kind of went bad here for us, our family, and get on top of it. Yeah, but tell us about your symposium, the symposium in November.
In November.
Yeah.
So the Huntington Study Group is an international collaboration of Huntington's investigators who operate and carry out clinical trials like CREST or 2CARE or Cohort. All of those were HSG trials. And they partner together because no one site usually has enough patients to get the critical number of patients that are needed for a clinical trial to show definitively a result. So what they do is the HSG has different clinical sites all over the country, and when they have a clinical trial that they're trying to get, they're trying to populate with appropriate candidates, they work together to see, Duke has 3 patients and Wake Forest has 4 patients. And so that's how they end up finding candidates for clinical trials. Anyway, it's been around for 25 years. It's, these people are international experts and have, years and years of clinical experience working with Huntington's families. And every year they get together and they have investigator meetings where they talk about the trials and they talk about how things are going. And they also have education sessions for the HSG investigators. And so that usually happens the first 2 days of their meeting. And then the last day of the meeting, which is Saturday, they run something called the Clinical Research Symposium, which is intended for a broader audience, including the general public in the Huntington's community, where clinical research is presented and discussed, usually along some type of a sort of a consistency, sort of a theme. There's usually an advocate, somebody from the community, an HD advocate, who makes a presentation. And so that's the morning. And then in the afternoon, there's their family workshops. So that's the way the meeting has been for the last 7 years. Last year, Dr. Goodman, being the groundbreaking person she is, she really is, she forges ahead. She organized, in conjunction with the HSG, the first local provider educational effort. So it was a 2-day continuing medical education program for local providers.
Nice.
And I think there were 48 people who attended last year. And, she didn't have a lot of time to pull it all together. So so when it was over with and they chose Charlotte, they asked me if I would help them do something similar in the Charlotte program. So we have a 2-day CME for anybody in the Southeast, actually anybody anywhere who wants to come. It's 16 hours of continuing medical education, which we all have to have, and it's at an extremely competitive price because we planned it that way. And we planned it with the idea that a provider's coming in completely ignorant. They don't know a single thing about Huntington's. And in fact, they may know misinformation about Huntington's.
Mm-hmm.
So we really start at the basics. And the first day is really all the basics of Huntington's. And each of the sort of symptom complexes are described in some depth and symptoms across the life cycle and ethical issues and emergencies. And so we cover all of the basics of that in the first day. And then the second day, which involves the symposium and the workshop, like I said, the first part of it is research. The workshops we designed a little differently this year so that we're going to split into 4 different groups, and each of those groups has sort of a main topic or theme.
Nice.
That they're going to address, and there's a couple facilitators in there. One of them is somebody that's not from the state, and the other is somebody who does work in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to pull in a poster and talk about how that poster helps them answer these kinds of questions. And then there's going to be question and answer, just like you and I are doing right now, about, you know, well, how do I deal with nursing home placement, or how do I deal with emergency situations, that kind of thing. So, and, you know, the hope is that as these people go through this program, they're going to get all the sort of intellectual parts of Huntington's, and then at the end they're going to get the emotional parts, the mm-hmm. connection part, that real, you know, person-to-person human contact.
Part.
It's right. so much, it's so important in a healing mm-hmm. relationship. So
so when is
I can't wait to see what's going to happen.
Yeah,
I really can't
exciting.
Wait.
When will the CMEs be?
That's Friday and Saturday, November 8th and 9th.
Okay.
And registration is, it's open at www.hsglimited.org.
Okay.
And there's information in there about what the program's like and the accreditation and so forth. So
is that a new website for HSG?
You know, I think we were trying to find a button to put it on, but I don't know if we have yet.
Oh.
So I go directly to the HSG website, and
uh-huh.
we're going to try hard to get it up on ours, but I don't know if we've gotten it up there quite yet. So.
Can you tell us who your keynotes are?
Who are what?
Who are your main speakers and that kind of thing?
Sure. So Carolyn Drasnick from the University of Connecticut is one of the talkers, one of the speakers. She's a psychiatrist who runs a really great program in Connecticut and she has a really big population. She's very personable. And so she's going to give the first talk. The second talk is going to be by Francis Walker, who runs the HD program at Wake Forest, and his is going to be about HD across the life cycle.
Mm.
So Dr. Drasnick will talk about what the core symptoms are, and then Dr. Walker is going to talk about how they map out over a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be a general education session, which means it's going to be for these local providers and for the HSG investigators. That's going to be about ethical dilemmas in Huntington's. So Philip Rosoff from Duke, who is the head of medical ethics at Duke, is going to facilitate conversations around particular clinical cases related to genetic testing and capacity or competence about employment discrimination. The fourth one. I can't remember what the fourth one is right off the top of my head. But they're all, you know, they're issues that there is no right or wrong answer to.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to, if you can come up with a way by which you approach those types of problems, you are more likely to help patients and families arrive at a well thought out decision about what to do. So that's one of the sessions. There's going to be a working lunch where the local providers are going to get together immediately after this genetics talk and have lunch and talk about what they've heard so far and meet one another. And Charles Sabin is going to be one of the guests during that lunch, and Donald Lowe, who's a neurobiologist from Duke, is going to be another guest during that lunch.
Great.
Yeah, it really is. Then we're going to talk about how to deliver healthcare in the community, how to people, not just people with Huntington's, but people that have complex problems that may be outside your skill set. You know, how do you go about taking care of that person? How do you go about building a team of providers for that person so that these emergencies you're talking about get nipped in the bud before
mm-hmm.
they happen? And then the last thing is another general session where Bonnie Hennig and Carolyn Drasnick and one other person are going to talk about HD emergencies.
Mm.
So both medical and mental health emergencies.
Mm-hmm.
And now, that'll round out that first day.
Is anything going to be recorded? Is anything going to be videoed? Or?
Well, we don't have plans to do that, but we do have plans to have written handouts for people that we're gonna post on the HSG site, so that they will be available to physicians afterwards and that they can share with their colleagues. So, and maybe one of these days we'll get it videotaped.
Oh God, that would be fabulous. And then your second day is chock full as well.
Yeah, it really is. There's Matt Ellison from the United Kingdom, who is a young man who started an organization called HDYO, which, like your organization, has reached out to young people affected by Huntington's all over the world, and they have sort of a similarly large audience as you do. And so Matt's going to come and talk about what it's like to grow up with Huntington's, and his talk is called The Impact of Huntington's on Young People, and I keep telling him he needs it to be The Impact of Young People on Huntington's Disease. It needs to be the exact opposite.
Yeah, that's great.
And then
are you going to have Jane Paulson, too?
Yeah, Jane Paulson is going to come and talk about the PREDICT information, and I'm trying to remember who else is coming. You'd think I would remember this agenda inside and outside, but I've thought about it similar to...
Do you have some people talking about the clinical trials that are going on?
Yep, that's what I'm trying to pull up. Here they are. So there's going to be presentations about biomarkers. Blair Levitt from British Columbia is going to do that. Kevin Bigland is talking about Prequel, which is the use of creatine in pre-manifest people. And then Neil Aronin from UMass is going to talk about sort of the science of the Huntington gene. And then there's going to be a couple of platform presentations. One of them is going to be about the use of alcohol and tobacco in Huntington's and whether that changes disease course. Another one is going to be early results from the REACH2HD study, which is the REACH2HD study that HSG is running. And then there's going to be a bunch of questions and answers with the audience. And that will round out the morning. And then the afternoon, Charles Sabine is going to address the community about what it's like to live holistically with Huntington's. Then we're going to break into small groups, and one of them is going to be about understanding behavior. The other one is going to be about improving quality of life. The other one's going to be about work and cognition, and then the last one is going to be about choices for at-risk individuals. And each of those breakout groups are, Jane Paulson is going to do one with me, and then Martha Nance is going to do one with Debbie Keelan Fuller, who's a genetic counselor at UNC. So there'll be two people in there. And we're going to also plant some specific people in there who have expertise that will expand on those people who are facilitators.
Nice. Kind of reinforce. One of the questions I had, you're talking about Dr. Goodman. We love her. She's one of our regular Ask Dr. Goodman show. She's been helping so many of us for quite a while. And I'm wondering about the algorithms. Have you had any breakthroughs with these algorithms that she has put together?
Well, the algorithms were put together because some of the science behind the medicine that we prescribe right now is taken from other disorders, and it's so, you know, I know, for example, about the use of risperidone in schizophrenia, so I have the majority of my experience in non-HD populations with antipsychotics, but So those drugs have, those risperidone and other drugs like it, even antidepressants or benzodiazepines, all really all the medications that are that we use to help treat symptoms in Huntington's, we sort of learned by trial and error. There haven't been big studies devoted to them because, you know, there wasn't enough money to do everything, and it seemed like it was important for us to get to the root of the problem, that if we could find disease-modifying treatments, that that would have the greatest benefit. So anyway, so what Dr. Goodman did with the algorithms was she created a starting place. She went and asked all the experts around the country to complete a survey. And she compiled that survey, and it what it did is it said that, you know, X percentage of HD experts use this drug as a first-line agent for this symptom.
Mm-hmm.
And she did that for chorea, she did that for perseveration or obsessive compulsive behaviors, and she did that for irritability. And so what that did is it created a starting place. That is that if everybody starts out with an antidepressant for irritability, then we're all going to understand better and better the benefits and the limitations of that. If you know, 80% of people, for example, respond to Prozac, then we know we're in the right direction. And so, you know, we talk about that. We talk about those kinds of, you know, how useful sort of standardizing treatment is. And not everybody agrees with all of that. There are a lot of people that believe that, you know, algorithms are just an excuse not to think. But I think it standardizes treatment. It gets us all in the same starting place. Mm-hmm. So we have a broader sense of what's useful. So the good result from Dr. Goodman's work is going to be that those algorithms have greater exposure to more physicians. So, and that patients have a better, families and patients have a better understanding of how to talk about specific symptoms in Huntington's. Like, you know, irritability in Huntington's is a specific symptom, and it's not something that people are taught in medical school. You have mm-hmm. to learn about it. And so, you know, that's how those are helpful. And then when doctors see these algorithms, they see who the authors are, and they figure out they're the people to call.
So,
and Dr. Goodman's right on the top of the list, isn't she?
Yes. So, we are so thankful for that.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so the symposium is going to be in November.
Mm-hmm, November 9th.
7 to 9 November
mm-hmm.
at
mm-hmm.
the Omni Charlotte Hotel.
That's right.
Okay. Now, is there a cost?
There's not a cost to the general public. There is a cost to physicians, which mm-hmm. is $150, and for non-physician healthcare providers who need continuing medical education credits, it's $50, which is a
okay.
complete bargain. But for the general community, there is no
oh,
cost.
Wonderful. Okay.
Yeah. And there's even...
going.
Yes. So we know that sometimes the people that need to come to these things the most are the most financially limited.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have a family scholarship program for North Carolina residents. And, you know, our hope is that we can give them gas money and put them up
well,
in a hotel.
That's wonderful.
And maybe
so
pay
how do they contact you then for that if they're looking for help?
There's an application form on the hsglimited.org at the registration site.
Okay.
When you register for it, down at the bottom of the page, it says for more information about the scholarship, go here. And I also think that there's information on our blog about it. So
okay.
In our blog, you can get our blog right off the front page of our website. So.
Okay, and your website again is?
hdreach.org.
HD, is there a dash?
Nope,
okay.
All one word, hdreach.org.
.org, or you can also go to hsglimited.org.
Yep, either place.
Awesome. Now you're getting back to HD Reach. I'm very curious to know how many people are aware of the change. Do you know? In your state?
In other words, how many people are aware that help is available to them?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
how are you doing with getting the information out?
Yeah, so a couple of different ways. One is that we give information to everybody that comes to the HD clinics. We give information to everybody that comes to support groups. And we give that information to anybody who's on the HDSA mailing list, for example, or email list. So we get it disseminated that way. This year, sort of in conjunction with the HSG meeting, we were fortunate to find a man who has many, many years in media and marketing experience. He runs an organization called ncpressrelease.com.
Nice.
And he volunteered to do some work for us at a reduced fee, which is most appreciated. So he came up with a marketing campaign that distributed articles and press releases every month, building up to the symposium. And there's been about, I got to pull out that information too, make sure I get the numbers right. So far he has sent out for us 185,000 emails, and they've been opened 33,000 times.
Oh,
there have
been
33,000 people that have opened emails over the course of this, and about 55% of those people who've opened emails are inside the borders in North Carolina. The rest are, in Albany, all 50 states and D.C. and Puerto Rico and 43 nations around the world. So
wonderful.
It has really gotten out there. It's been very rewarding to see. And what's been particularly interesting for us is that not only did that happen, we had 20 doctors we'd never known about who showed up and asked us for information, 20 brand new doctors.
Oh,
we
wow.
had no knowledge of them. And we have had a huge increase in phone calls from people looking for help. I mean, like a 250% increase in contacts, which is
that is fantastic.
Just amazing. And we've had
press works. Marketing works.
The reason it works is because this man has built these media contacts and relationships over all these years.
Yeah.
I mean, if I send out a press release, very few people are going to open it. But when he sends out a press release, lots of people open it. So
he has a good reputation for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now he's done it for many years, and that my hope is that we will get him engaged in the larger HD cause.
Mm. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Wouldn't it be?
Mm-hmm.
He's pretty intrigued, which I think is really a small slice of wonderful.
Yeah. You never know. You never know through the contacts that you make. You never know who's going to show an interest. It's kind of a fishing, you're fishing out there.
Yeah. I think it's kind of hard to get a ball rolling, It's hard to start something and get it going.
Mm-hmm.
And raise enough money to get it going, and raise enough willpower to get it going.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to find stamina somehow to keep things going, and that's almost as difficult. Because in the beginning, everything's fun and new, and you're excited, and then one day, it's just work. Mm-hmm. And you don't feel like, if you feel like you're going up a hill and you're not making much progress, and then you roll down that hill and things speed up again. So, kind of like any business, there are peaks and valleys.
Yes,
so.
That is true. I think, James, do we have any comments or questions in the chat room?
No, we don't.
But
everybody was listening intently.
I think there's one. I don't know if you have the same chat room that I do here. Deb Madden. She says, the best thing we can do as a community is to educate our professionals on the manifestations of HD. And she says, Dr. Edmondson is absolutely correct. We have a responsibility to our community to educate them.
Well, I will tell you that HD Reach was built on the backs of Huntington's families. Everybody that started on, all of our founding board members, the vast majority of them were from Huntington's families.
Yeah.
And that's still true today. And the vast majority of the people who support us financially are Huntington's families, or they are friends of Huntington's families.
Mm-hmm.
And I think so. It takes some courage to ask people to help.
Mm-hmm.
It's very humbling to ask people to help you, because sometimes you feel like you're asking for handouts and charity. And in fact, what you're doing is you're asking people to invest in your idea,
mm-hmm.
which is an entirely different way of going about doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's really important for us to speak up for ourselves. And I'm talking more as a HD family member right now than I am as a doctor, because
mm-hmm.
I really believe that sometimes we listen to our own press a little too much, and that this is a rare disease, and you know, people aren't going to care about it. But the truth of the matter is there people will care. People do care. The
mm-hmm.
human side of Huntington's is a very compelling story. It's a very compelling story. And it's a very human story. And there's a lot of really great people out there who, you know, care. And you might ask somebody to help you out, and they can't help you out then, but they say, come back and ask me again.
Mm-hmm.
So
we all kind of are going through stages, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, and you go through peaks and valleys in your family life. If you're part of a Huntington's family, there's periods of time when things are easy and things are going along okay, and then there are periods of time when things are really, really hard, and there's no way you could participate in some way to reach out to your broader community for their assistance. But if there are, and it's such a relief sometimes to have some of the suffering associated with Huntington's over with, and the grief of, you know, what you live through in your family, that the last thing you want to do is talk about Huntington's anymore, you know?
Right.
But if we don't, no one's going to fix this thing. It's just not going to get fixed.
I know.
And I think we're the people that are going to drive that. I think the HD family community is going to drive that. And I think it's by telling your story and about, you know, striving and all the stuff that is so wonderful for me as a physician to see. I mean, I just am constantly educated by my patients and their families, and constantly inspired. So,
Well, we don't stop learning until till the end, right? I mean,
we stop, right?
We are just going to keep learning more and more. I have a question from one of our
mm-hmm.
chat room people. She says, where would you direct a family doctor to learn more about HD? She says, my husband is not our GP's first HD patient, but he is much younger than the late-stage patient that he had 15 years ago. Would
mm-hmm.
you send them to hdreach.org?
You can go to our website, and I'll tell you where to look on our website. Hang on, let me pull it up so that I'm certain that I'm sending this to the right place. So there's a section called For Families. And let's see if that's probably not it. There's one. We have under resources. There are medical resources, and let's see. Our social worker puts all this stuff together. So there's one called Resources in Other States. And in here somewhere, there's a link to a resource page at HDSA that has a couple of pretty important documents in it. One of them is the HDSA Guide to Physicians. It's
downloadable now.
Yeah, it's downloadable. And there's another book in there called Understanding Behavior in Huntington's Disease, which is excellent.
Is that also downloadable?
That's also downloadable.
Okay, good. Dr. Goodman's algorithms are available, too, for you to download and print. If you just go to wehaveaface.org/HDDW, you can get her algorithms there as well, which are very helpful. We've had a number of feedback from patients and MDs. They're very happy to get them. And they're also available on HelpHD mobile app, so you can get them there as well. Very, very helpful.
Yeah, they certainly are. And I'd stay tuned for this whole idea about telemedicine and telepsychiatry. The platform, the IT platform for telemedicine is become very reasonable in price. And that means that a physician or a group of physicians can buy access to this platform, and it's HIPAA compliant, meaning that it's confidential, right? And it's double encrypted, so people can't hack into it as easily. I'm not saying they can't hack into it, but they can't. They're going to have to be pretty creative to hack into it, and pretty malicious to hack into it. But in any case, it's as good as it gets. And over that platform, will be available on an iPad. So you'll be able to take your iPad into the emergency room with you, or you'll be able to take your iPad in to see your primary care doctor.
Fantastic.
And if there's some, some scheduling ahead of time that, whoever that their HD expert physician is, that they can, if there's some kind of a problem, that they can all talk by phone or all talk by over video. So I think that those technologies are getting less expensive and hopefully more available to
I have a feeling that's where things are going.
Well, I think your program is kind of an example of that, we're in the first generation.
We're so happy to have you back on the show, and it sounds like your symposium is going to be fantastic. I wish I could go. I can't. So are you looking for, your website stated that you're looking for partnerships, but what kind of partnerships are you looking for?
All kinds. We are interested in providers who would have an interest in seeing a patient or two or a caregiver or two. So, people that just want a little bit of information. We are happy to talk with long-term care facilities. We're happy to talk with people who are long-term care providers in home, physical therapists, occupational therapists, yoga instructors, you name it, anybody that would be willing to learn. And so it's sort of on an individual provider level that we look for partners, but we also look for partners in organizations. So there's a organization called the Caring Voice Coalition that's out of Virginia that works with families who are going through the process of disability. And we refer people to them all the time because they do a much better job with helping people through the disability process than we can over the phone. So we assist them by helping their physicians, and then the families go to the Caring Voice Coalition to get the nuts and bolts of the application put together. And sometimes some advice, like, am I eligible for disability even if I'm disabled? I haven't worked for X number of years. Does that mean I'm not eligible anymore? So just questions about eligibility and the application process itself. So So we sort of put one piece together and we get another piece from our partners, and then that way the whole thing gets done.
That's fantastic.
And also making sure that it's executed, because it's one thing to suggest something to somebody, but then they get stuck on some part and they're hitting their head against the wall trying to figure out what they need to do next, and then they get a call from our social worker who said, "Did you get that? Were you able to get that?" And and she'll help them pass that difficult spot. So
that's fantastic. We need this model everywhere. Honestly, we just, you know, not every HD family can make it to a center of excellence.
Well, I can tell you that 5 years ago, those of us in North Carolina who were sitting around those first support group meetings, we were pretty discouraged because we would bring people in to talk to us in our support group meetings, and we ended up educating them as opposed to getting any useful information from them. And that went on for quite a while. And, you know, there were moments that we were very discouraged, and we'd hear about what goes on in other places that seems like they just are in so much better shape than we were. And, in fact, they were. And I remember listening to somebody talk like I'm talking right now and feeling extremely discouraged, because I'm like, why can't we have that here?
You know? I know, that's what I'm thinking too. Why can't we have that here?
Why can't I have that here? But
it takes a lot of organization for that.
Well, it just takes 10 people sitting around the kitchen table deciding that they want to come up with a better way, that they want to come up with a better way for their community. It's not, you get together because as a community of people you want to make a change. Not any one person can do it. It has to be, you have to find a couple other people like you who are willing to put in a couple hours a week, and then you just put one foot in front of the other, and you hit obstacles, and you fall back for a while and try and figure out how you're going to get past that, and you think about it until you figure it out.
Got to be a pit bull and pearls.
Yeah. Well, and I think I would suspect that the vast majority of people who are sitting here on this phone right now listening to us are people who are in the trenches of taking care of Huntington's or living with Huntington's, and that it's not the time in their life to go out and mobilize their community necessarily. But it is a time when you could ask someone that you know that cares about you to do it on your behalf.
Right.
Just say, can you give a couple of hours a week? Just all I want you to do is give a couple of hours a week and go sit down and meet with these people and see if you guys can come up with some ideas that will help. Just one or two things. Just one or two things that you can think of in your non-HD life that you can come up with that would help. It's like I said, it's very hard to ask for help. It's very humbling. It's very humbling.
Well, I think you're going to have a good turnout at your symposium. Again, go to hdreach.org or hsglimited.org. Would really love to have people from out of state go. That would be great.
Yeah,
and
I would love to be able to do
that. We are offering a family scholarship for those within the state of North Carolina, which is awesome.
Yep.
Is there anything else that we forgot to mention?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I think we covered it.
Yeah.
James, did we have any other comments or questions that you know of?
No, not at this time. But thank you
so
much, Dr. Edmondson, for coming on.
Excellent.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well,
I think we'll go ahead and close the show. And
Thanks so much for inviting me. I know it's not a show that provides much in the way of practical support for people out there, but invite me back after this meeting, and I'll
definitely
tell you everything.
Oh my goodness!
Everything
can't wait for that.
Can share with you.
And if anyone at the symposium would like to come on, please extend my open invitation to those folks that could offer amazing information for our community.
Yeah. I would be happy to do that because I can think of a few people right now, right off the top of my head, who I think would be great.
It's so important to get the information out there, and you know, we've been able to reach a population that no one else has been able to reach, just for the fact that it's, you know, technology that nobody else is really using. Radio, online radio, is the first for Huntington's. And not everybody can go to events and, you know, go to conventions and symposiums and things like that, but they can tune in, click a link, and listen at their whatever time they want. If it's 2 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they can listen. And this information is so critically important for all of us to listen to. We've had so many wonderful professionals such as yourself, Dr. Goodman. Iris Olson's been on a couple of times. I mean, we've had all of the researchers, the key researchers in the U.S., even Canada and U.K. have been on. Australia people have been on. So, you know, we have so much information, and it's going to help, you know. It's going to help.
Well, and I think knowing that you're not alone and knowing that people do care, it's sort of, you know, that folks put their time and their energy into finding solutions for this in a way validates your need. You know, it's like if you're in a community and you've got problems and no one seems to be able to help you and you're struggling with it all by yourself, you're like, okay, is there something wrong with me that I can't solve this problem? Or, you know, what's wrong with me that I can't solve this problem? And the truth of the matter is that there are lots of people around who are having the same trouble you are. They just don't have to happen to be two doors down from your house, you know?
Right.
And so you got to find them two doors down from your house in communities like yours and at HD Buzz and at HDO and, you know, all the spots that are popping up around the world to meet these needs. And
well, we've definitely had an increase in nonprofit organizations just in the last year. There's Help for HD Families, Marissa Gutierrez. There's, my mind is blank now, of course, when I want to say something. But, James, what's the one?
You have NJ Cure HD?
Huh?
There's also the
NJ
Cure HD.
Philly Cure HD.
Philly Cure.
I mean, there's so many of them out there now. It's inspiring to see the interest that they're taking in helping the communities that they serve, you know.
So. Well, and I think, so one of the things that you can sit down and read somebody's mission statement or their vision statement, and it's just, you know, but the question is, you know, what really are the problems you're trying to address with your community?
Mm-hmm.
And what you guys are doing to address the 76,000 people who listen to your show is you're trying to give them something that they can access any time of the day, and you're trying to give them access to some of the smartest people, myself excluded, who know a bunch about Huntington's, like Iris Olson and LaVon Goodman and so forth. So they get the benefit of the knowledge and wisdom of those people, even though they can't necessarily get to them. And so you have filled this niche. That's why you guys have 76,000 listeners. And HD Buzz has got a niche because they are scientists and they knew how to translate all that complex information
mm-hmm.
into something that regular people can read.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, HTO was like, well, I know everybody says they want to reach out to young people, but we're not getting there, so let's figure out a different way to do it. And it's you know, HD is a big problem. It doesn't take just one person or just one organization to fix it. I mean, it takes a lot of creative energy, so, and a lot of commitment.
Yep. Well,
you're right. There's I know you are.
Well, again, Dr. Edmondson, thank you so much. And I can't wait to talk to you after the symposium. We'll have to come back on the show and fill us in.
I will. I'd be happy to do that.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Okay, so this concludes our show tonight. Thank you again. Thank you, everyone, for listening, spending this time with us. And come back and listen to the on-demand episodes. And you can also get the free app, Help for HD, the original mobile connection to education resources and information about JHD and HD. Also, the show is available on the app. And also, Dr. Mary Edmondson is on the app. So, talk to you next week, and you have a wonderful week. Thank you again, Dr. Edmondson. Have a great symposium. Can't wait to talk to you again.
Thank you.
Okay, take care, everyone. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Good night, everyone.